You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 488.
I'm as cool as a cucumber in a bowl of hot sauce. MCA.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Indie Film Hustle's Filmmaker Process. We provide filmmakers with professional services to get their films or series funded, finished, and distributed. Some of the services we offer are pitch deck creation, film budgets and schedules, domestic and international sales estimates, legal contract templates, consulting, post-production services, script coverage, professional trailer editing, poster design, film deliverables, and production payroll. To learn more, go to www.filmmakerprocess.com. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Well, guys, today on the show, we have filmmaker Jeremy Elkin, who just directed a documentary that was very close to my heart called All the Streets Are Silent, The Convergence of Hip Hop and Skateboarding from 1987 to 1997. Now, many of you guys might have known that I was raised in New York during these years, probably a little bit earlier than that. And I was there to see the birth of hip-hop, breakdancing, street culture. And I was very young at that time, but it's something that still is still inside of my blood. And when I saw this documentary, it really brought me back to that place. And I wanted to talk to Jeremy not only about how he put this whole thing together, which is a massive undertaking of thousands and thousands of hours of footage, but just talk hip hop, talk skateboarding, talk street culture and how all that came together. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Jeremy Elkin. I'd like to welcome to the show Jeremy Elkin. Man, how you doing, Jeremy?
Hi.
How you doing, man? So I wanted to bring you on the show, man. I saw your film, All the Streets Are Silent, and it really hit a chord with me, man, because I was, like I was telling you before, I was raised in New York as a kid. So for most of the 70s and up until about 85, I was in New York, and my stepdad was a cab driver. So I would ride with him throughout Manhattan, and I saw hip hop coming up. And breakdancing and skateboarding and all that, Washington Square, I was all in that stuff. I was a young kid at the time, but I saw it happening. So when I saw this, I was like, oh man, I'm back home. So how did the project get together, man? How did you put the whole thing together?
It's a big question. which part of it?
Well, just in general, like, I mean, so what was the genesis of the project? Like, how did you, like, at what point did you go, I got to put this thing together, I got to tell this story?
Yeah, so, you know, I made skate videos for a long time, and I made documentaries for a while, and I had always known that Eli Gesner had this, like, magical archive based on his footage that was in New York mixtape, and I knew that he was at the Stretch and Bob radio show a lot. I knew he was a club promoter, but I didn't really know the full extent until we started to dive in. So yeah, to be perfectly honest, I didn't know there was a story until probably like a year and a half in to making it. Didn't really know if it was anything more than just a behind the scenes on how Mixtape was made. Mm-hmm. And it really wasn't until we discovered Yuki Watanabe, who's the founder of the nightclub Mars, until we discovered his archive from the nightclub, that's when the story opened up.
Now, how can you explain to people the importance of Mars? Because I had Moby on the show a little while ago, and Moby talked about Mars like it was, you know, the second coming. So can you take the importance of those years? Because it wasn't around for a long time. It was around, what, 4 or 5 years, something like that?
2 years.
Oh, two. It was only around 2 years? Jesus.
Yeah, it was midnight of, like, New Year's Eve of 89, and it closed spring of 92.
Oh, Jesus. So it was only
January 1990 to like, you know, April or May of 92. I mean, yeah.
So a couple years, but it was such an impactful club. Can you explain to people what that was about?
Yeah. So it was actually not a hip hop club. Yeah. It was a club that had many different genres of music, and every floor was a different genre. That's how Yuki and Rudolph set it up. And Yuki was a DJ and he was super interested in the youth. And so he set up this little radio station called Radio Mars, where he would record mixes in his little office, and he would audition DJs for the next week or whatever, right? And people would drop off demo tapes. They would come, you know, do a session for him, and he would figure out who could pair with who and what floor they would go on and whatever. But it wasn't about hip hop until there was one evening, famously, when Beasley, who's a character in the film, found a microphone with Eli, the narrator, and this is in the basement. They had like this house party in the basement. They plugged in the mic, and word got around that there was a mic where you could rap, because in the basement was house, but they were like playing hip hop. Like, they weren't supposed to play hip hop because it brought like bad insurance, whatever. And Yuki didn't want it because it meant like gang violence, but they started playing like De La Soul and Tribe and Black Sheep. And not Black Sheep, that was later. De La Soul and Tribe and, you know, Jungle Brothers and those guys, all the Native Tongues. And they had a mic, and Run DMC showed up and, you know, and were like, you know, this is how you rhyme kind of thing. And I think just word got out in the community that there was the ability to go to a club with a DJ and you had a mic. So that's sort of that was like the birth of, I think, the club blowing up. And that was within the first, like, you know, let's say 6 months of it opening.
And then I saw in the video, in the film, that there, you had some footage of Jay-Z, a young, unknown Jay-Z just rapping on the mic.
Yeah.
That was insane.
Yeah, that was Yuki's wife actually filmed that. It was a crazy one. That tape was like, that's a whole other story of discovering the tape. But yeah, Jay-Z was, you know, completely unknown under Jazzo's wing coming up.
Right.
And Jazzo sort of gave him the chain that night to wear. And I think he just went off. And he had never seen that footage. We showed it to him maybe a year ago. And he couldn't believe it. He didn't even know anyone recorded it.
He didn't even know that Jay-Z ever played that club. Because obviously he didn't know who Jay-Z was. So he just was another rapper, right?
Right. I'm saying like Jay-Z didn't even know that it was recorded.
Oh, Jay-Z didn't even know it was recorded.
Yeah, no, he didn't know. But no, Yuki, yeah, he didn't know. You know, these are all unknown rappers. It's like if, you know, it's like if we go to a club next week and there's a bunch of people rhyming, like,
and then Eminem shows up.
We're certainly not going to tape it. And I think Yuki and his wife both had, and Eli as well, but, you know, Eli was a lot younger back then, but they had the foresight to record, you know, once or twice a week, they would record performances at the club. And that was just happened to be one of those nights. Yeah. And I think they only recorded that because if you watch in the film, the Jungle Brothers, he's kind of doing a dance.
Yeah.
And there's like an interviewer there from, I think, MTV or VH, something like that. And they're interviewing him. And so they were filming the Jungle Brothers being interviewed on broadcast TV. Like the cameraman was in there. So I wonder, I don't know if they were in there to record the Jungle Brothers as an interview in the club.
Right.
This is according to like what I've seen in the tape. I mean, Yuki doesn't remember. They don't remember. But I don't think the cameraman would have had the, you know, I don't think they were recording all the musical performances that night. I mean, it was a lot of people going on. I doubt they got it in that quality. But, you know, Yuki's wife was able, Mayumi Watanabe was able to record it. And she labeled the tape rap street style New York group or something.
So it would have never been able to, like, how the hell do you find that in the probably thousands and thousands of tapes they had?
Yeah. So he was only giving me the tapes that were properly labeled. And then there was like another 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 tapes that were unlabeled. They were mainly house and disco and not really the nights. You know, it was like a gay night. It was this night, that sure. night. It wasn't really like, it wasn't like a hip hop night collection. The hip hop was sort of embedded in the rest of the archive. So, you know, they would make these highlight reels of each evening. So, for instance, you know, one evening it was, I think the tape where the Jay-Z appeared that I saw a glimpse of him on was a mashup of a variety of evenings. And there was a glimpse of like 2 to 3 seconds at most mute of Jay-Z on the mic. And I called Yuki right away. I was like, where's the Jay-Z tape? What's that? He's like, he never played in Mars. No, he wasn't there. I would have known him, you know? And I was like, no, I'm pretty sure it's Jay-Z. I sent him a picture and he's like, yeah, it looks like him. I'm like, no, it's for sure Jay-Z.
It's Jay-Z.
And he's like, well, I don't know. Like, it must be in an unlabeled tape, you know, if we have it. Because those highlight reels, you know, Mayumi and him were like doing the tape-to-tape editing or whatever it was called, where you would make like a highlight reel of a variety of tapes onto one tape, but you couldn't have, like, the audio wouldn't transfer with it. So you just put, you choose a song and then you would layer in footage, you know, and that's what that was in. Yeah.
So you mentioned the Zoo York mixtape. Can you tell people what Zoo York was and the importance of Zoo York in this whole movement?
So yeah, Zoo York was a skate company founded by Rodney Smith, Adam Schatz, and Eli Gesner in 93. Adam Schatz and Eli had come over from doing Fat Farm. And Rodney was the founder of Shut Skateboards, which is the first New York skate company. In the early 80s. And so they sort of combined forces after Eli had success with Mars and Fat Farm, developing Fat Farm under Russell. He, you know, they got together, started Zoo York, and it was kind of like the first, it was really like the first successful East Coast skate company, I guess you could say. Because Shut had some success, but it was definitely underground and more like transition pool skaters. Zoo York was really street and it had like the hip hop roots graffiti aspect with the tags. And yeah, it just was a really like raw street brand that existed for about, 7, 8 years before it got bought by Marc Ecko and it became something else. But during those first years, 93 to 2000-ish, it was as good as it gets for street skating on the East Coast.
And then, so because at that point, basically West Coast owned the skating world. I mean, with Tony Hawk and the what are those guys called? Dogtown, Z Boys and Dogtown, and they kind of. I'm not sure who were they. They were the first to skateboard, right? Were they West Coast? Or is there a conversation?
There's a lot more crews. Like there was the EMB crew in San Francisco. There was a lot of amazing skaters in LA that were doing street skating, just like the Zoo York guys. Mm-hmm. It just, the only mainstream press was, only the mainstream press was picking up Tony Hawk, the Z Boys, et cetera. But there were a million skate companies that were awesome on the West Coast. It wasn't like, if anything, the Tony Hawk, the Z Boys were seen as corny. And the Menace and some of the like girl chocolate skateboard guys, Spike Jonze's crew, those guys were like the skaters that everyone like looked up to, at least from the type of skating that I grew up enjoying.
Right, and then the whole skate scene in New York was a lot more. I mean, again, I was raised there, so it's a lot grittier. There's no palm trees. There's no beaches. You don't want to go to the beaches most of the time, things like that. So the energy was just so different. Now, at what point did the street culture combine with hip hop? Was that the mixtape?
I think there's a lot of examples of it. You know, I think even going way, way back to like breakdancing circles and the projects in the 80s, sure like there were kids with skateboards. There was a DJ in the park and there was a couple of dudes breakdancing and doing graffiti. I'm sure it was always like part of one thing. I think it wasn't so like black and white. But I think the mixtape just like showed as Josh Kalis puts it in the film, he says they show how close they were in relation, I think, you know, as opposed to like, you know, some like abstract archival photo from the mid 80s. I think just seeing a 40-minute version of that was way more impactful. And just the fact that like, clearly the guy, Eli, who was at the radio station and the guy filming the skating, also Eli and RB O'Malley, you could tell they were using the same cameras. It might have even been from the same tape. So I think that's what really like hit home to people. It wasn't like they just scraped the internet for X footage and then paired it with the footage they were filming. It was all part of the same body of work. And that's probably why it hit harder, you know?
Now, two of the main people in the movie that are in all this archival footage is Harold and Justin, who, I mean, gone too soon was lack of course, but their characters, I mean, Harold, I mean, he's a legend. I mean, there's people wearing his name, his face on t-shirts still, and he passed years ago. I knew him from, I was introduced to him by, for Kids. I mean, I saw Kids in the theater, and when I saw Kids, you know, I was just completely blown away. Rosario Dawson, who's in your movie. I think that was her first movie, right? That was her first movie was Kids.
Correct, yeah.
Can you explain, can you explain first of all what Kids was and then what that impact, because Kids blew up in a kind of an underground world. It wasn't like a massive worldwide hit or anything, but it was a big thing, especially for basically a bunch of street kids, you know, just running around skateboarding. What was Kids, and then how did that affect Harold and Justin as far as what, how did it affect their lives?
Yeah, so Harmony was in town. You know, he moved to New York from the South, I think, where he's from, to attend school, to attend college. I'd be getting this wrong, but I think like the new school at SVA, I think it was the new school. And one of his, I think it was his thesis project, was the script for what became Kids. And Larry Clark, who was a seasoned filmmaker, photographer at that time, I think he saw something in Harmony and, you know, he needed a writer, and Harmony was like, well, I'm basically, you know, I don't want to get this wrong, but something like that, where they, you know, they joined forces, decided to make this movie based on the Kids at Washington Square Park. That's the gist of it. Right. They decided to cast, you know, kids from Alphabet City and Lower East Side and Washington Square and Tompkins, East Village, and kind of create a film that was like just so real that it could have just been a documentary. That was, I think, the goal. But it's just about, you know, what kids get into in their everyday lives downtown New York.
And how did that fame and exposure affect Harold and Justin psychologically? Could you talk a little bit about that in the doc?
Yeah, I think you know, it must have been pretty nuts. I mean, you know, I don't think Harold was getting paid by Supreme. I think whatever board royalties and wheels and shirts, whatever he was getting from New York was probably maybe $1,000, whatever he was getting a month, you know. They were not exactly like rolling in the dough or forget about profitable. They weren't really like recognizable outside of the bubble of like the 100 skaters who skated in New York, you know, like it was tiny. And then all of a sudden he was like at the Lowe's cinema on the big screen and selling out movie theaters. I think it's a huge change.
Right.
You know, I think that, like, it must've really messed with him and Justin, I think, with their like hopes and their aspirations of what they wanted to do as kids in the downtown scene. It for sure probably changed. And then, you know, they were also getting older, and I think, I don't remember what year, I don't know, remember how old Harold was when Kids came out, but he must have not been more than 20 or 21 years old, you know,
right.
maybe 18. Or he was young for sure.
Yeah.
So yeah, huge impact.
Now, you know, when you approach this project, you know, I've been editing for years, man. How the hell did you go? How did you approach this? I mean, you're talking about thousands of hours of footage on, what was it? Hi-8 tape?
It's a mix of Hi-8 and mini DV primarily. And then there were, like, you know, obviously photographs, 16 mil reels, 8 millimeter, et cetera.
How the hell did you, I mean, I'm assuming you had help, because I can't believe you did it all yourself as far as just cataloging all this stuff.
Yeah, the cataloging was done by a few people who came in. At the very start, it was definitely like, you know, three people, one or two of them a week for the first, like, you know, 3-4 months. And then after that, it was really just me and my assistant Kyber who stayed on and helped develop it. You know, we developed it together, I think, in terms of like figuring out, you know, A, B, C grade footage, you know.
Now, as far as the story goes, I'm always fascinated when I talk to documentary filmmakers about, you know, you discover the story as you go along. And that's something that a lot of filmmakers listening don't understand on the documentary side. Like, yeah, you can maybe have a script, maybe you have an outline, maybe you have a thing that you want to kind of go after. But when you start, like, you meet that one interview, you're like, oh my God, that just took me off to a complete new direction. How did you approach the storytelling of this? I mean, did you, like you said before, it could have just been a behind the scenes of the mixtape. But once you've got that one interview, how did you kind of like structure it all? Like, how did you put it together, outlining it and stuff?
Yeah, so I think it's a 3-part answer. One, my boss when I was at Vanity Fair was the producer on the film. And he was at Vanity Fair for 25 years. He's an amazing journalist, amazing editor, writer. So working with him, the way that we work, it was just the same as what we had at Vanity Fair. So we work really well together. And I think that's part of the success of the story is the two of us. I think if he had just been doing, he's not a filmmaker, but if he had just been doing it on his own with someone else, maybe it wouldn't have looked the same. I think I would have gone a little nuts had I not had him. I think he really like, you know, helped sort of like, I think he just, you know, he saw the bigger picture, but he also let me tell it. It was an interesting relationship, you know, like I think that's, you know, the bottom line here is that it's Eli's story. It's narrator Eli Gessner. It's his archival footage for the most part, you know, largely it's 60-70% of it. The film is his archive, meaning that I was trying to just tell it as he was, you know, as what he was recording. So he didn't record Janet Jackson in Midtown. There's no Janet, you know, there's certain things that aren't in the story that might pertain to like her dating Q-Tip or this, some weird other connection. Those are left out if we didn't have the footage. We weren't just like taking things off the internet and then figuring out how they were aligned. It was really like, what is the basis of Eli's collection and how is there a story in there? You know, that was first and foremost. And yeah, it's like, you know, it's totally Eli's. It's what happened to Eli and also what Eli recorded that's the result of the film. Like that's like the core of the movie.
What got you into filmmaking? What made you want to be a filmmaker?
Yeah, I don't know. It's just, it felt like, I never was like, I want to be a filmmaker. It wasn't like that. It was like,
you didn't have pictures of Scorsese on the wall and shit.
No, I haven't even, honestly, I've probably seen like 1% of the movies that most filmmakers see. Like, I don't like watch a ton of movies. Mm-hmm. I make things all the time and I just, the medium is film, but I'm not like a student of film, you know, like I probably watch a movie a month or something. And like, I don't watch movies. Mm-hmm. It's just the medium that I'm using, you know, it's the thing that I guess I'm good at or is easy for me. And, that's sort of it. So it's not like I wouldn't have like some big master plan to be like a director. It was never that. I never wanted to be a director. I always wanted to be a designer. And so it just sort of like fell into this.
Yeah. How did you fall into it? Like, what was was it a job because of Vanity Fair?
I just started filming skateboarding in Montreal, growing up in MTL. It was like, there weren't many people who had video cameras. And I looked up to this guy, Eric LeBeau downtown. Shout out to Eric. He's awesome. Great, great dude. And he had the VX1000 Sony that I was like 12 years old, so I couldn't afford that. But he was, you know, it's inspiring to see him out there every day. And I just was like, I want to do that, like whatever that is. But also like my friends were way better than me at skating and they were doing tricks that were arguably better than what I was seeing in the video. So I was like, someone's got to film this. And so, you know, picked up a camera and then made one skate video and another and another and another, and then wound up doing things outside of skateboarding. And then sort of now we're here.
That's kind of like how Spike started, Spike Jonze.
Yeah, a lot of, I mean, not just Spike, like Ty Evans. I mean, there's a lot of amazing filmmakers that come from just, you know,
the skate world.
Skateboarding, yeah.
Now, I always ask this question of my guests. What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
I think just like the things take time, like don't rush anything. I think that's the like, that's like the number one. You know, I'm interested in how people connect and how things develop and how scenes sort of intertwine. And that's always been interesting to me. So, you know, the film is a natural progression, but yeah, I think that's just, you know, I would say just do something that you love and you're passionate about.
And do you have any advice for filmmakers trying to like kind of make it in today's world?
I don't know. That's another question. I'm just gonna plug in my laptop. Just give me a second.
Sure.
Okay, we're good.
Yeah. So, do you have any advice for filmmakers that are trying to break into the business today?
Yeah, I mean, just meet everyone you can and be good to people, and you know, try and make. I mean, the biggest advice that I would say is like, if you're gonna make a story about a place, or if the story that you're trying to tell is in a certain place, like live in that place. Don't make a film about Tokyo living in Australia. You know what I mean? Like it's just not going to have the same texture or the same sound or the same feeling as someone who understands their environment, I think.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So many filmmakers the Australian who makes a movie about Tokyo or New York and had never been there. And they just, what they grab is they grab it from the internet or books or movies and things like that. There's nothing like actually living it, breathing it, being there, especially a documentarian. I mean, you've got to as a documentarian.
Yeah. I mean, the walking out your door, whether it's in New York or anywhere else, like you kind of want the environment to inspire you. You want it to be like a constant source of inspiration and, you know, just make things in the same environment as your work. You know, I don't know. That's you know, like take in the typography and the architecture and the smell and the pollution and the whatever element is out there in your city. Put that in the picture and in the sound, it's going to make a huge difference than if you're like, than if it wasn't in there, if you're just researching. Yeah.
What inspires you as an artist, man? What kind of makes your juices flow?
Just honestly, like opening the front door. That's like the best thing. Just going, I can just walking in one direction for like 8 hours or an hour, whatever it is, even just going around the block. You just, at least I live downtown in the city in New York, and it's like, that's the inspiration for me. You know, I don't know. I like seeing just how different every second of every day is here.
And where can people watch the movie?
So the film is out. Well, when is this there?
I think right before it comes out. So,
so the film comes out July 30th,
right.
Nationwide. It's limited release in New York up until then. And then September 7th, it'll be out on digital platforms, on Apple, and on, I believe, on Amazon as well. But don't quote me.
And where and what are you doing next? What are you working on now?
Working on a few projects that I unfortunately can't talk about, but exciting, super exciting stuff.
Yeah. Jeremy, thank you so much for being on the show, brother. I appreciate your time, and thanks for putting this together, man. This tells a story that hasn't been told before, so I appreciate you, man.
Thanks so much, man. I really appreciate it.
I want to thank Jeremy for coming on the show and sharing his adventures with us. Thank you so much, Jeremy. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/488. Thanks so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.